According to the World Bank, over 1.2 billion people lived on less than $1.25 a day in 2010. And although the World Bank projects growth in sub-Saharan Africa will be over 5% this year, nearly half the people there continue to live in poverty. Nations, agencies, and individuals have been striving to aid the poor for decades. So why, despite all the effort and expertise, do poverty rates remain so high? NYU economics professor William Easterly's latest book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor, is published by Basic Books. I'm very pleased it has brought William Easterly back to our show. Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
How severe is the problem of poverty now compared with 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, there's actually been a lot of progress. I would not attribute that progress to aid efforts primarily. It's actually amazing what poor people have been doing for themselves. They've been fighting for the spread of democracy throughout the world, which has, despite some of the recent troubles, has actually made advances over the past several decades. And that's one of the key things that this book is about.
So this steady improvement doesn't indicate that something is being done right?
Well, something is being done right, but
you're saying it's all by the individuals themselves.
Yes. Yes.
We're seeing absolutely no advantage of from the NGOs and
I think some NGOs do a lot of good, but they are operating on a very small scale. All official aid put together is a small fraction of a percent of the total economy of poor countries. So it's just too small to make much of a difference in the big picture that we're seeing, which is overall economic development and the spread of freedom.
Well, we're talking about poor countries, but a country like the United States, UK, we also have real problems with poverty. Maybe not $1.25 a day, but the equivalent, considering how expensive this country is.
Absolutely, yeah.
So are we looking at our own situations differently than we look at the situations elsewhere?
Well, I think, first of all, the big picture in the U.S. is not only of inequality, but also of big rise in living standards over a very long period of time. That's been the fruit of our free system, where people have rights to demand that their governments provide them with clean water and good roads and all the things they need to prosper.
From 1985 to 2001, you worked at the World Bank, where the official goal is reduction of poverty. How effective has it been at meeting that goal?
Well, in this book, I really look at the role of the World Bank in promoting ideas, and I'm sad to say that it's really promoting the wrong ideas.
Though you worked there?
Well, I myself was part of...
You were there 16 years.
I confess freely that I myself was part of the problem. If the problem in this book is the tyranny of experts, I have to confess I'm sort of a recovering expert myself.
A lot of people feel kindlier to the World Bank than they do to the International Monetary Fund. What role has it had?
Well, they both are pretty similar in one thing that I think causes a lot of justifiable resentment against them, which is the arrogance and the coercion that they follow, in which they try to impose their idea of what are the right policies and reforms on other countries, kind of blackmailing them with aid and loan funds.
My guest is William Easterly. His latest book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor, is published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In your previous book, The White Man's Burden, which brought you here, 2006?
Yeah.
You argued that the facts just don't support many of the claims made for aid to poor developing nations. Does Tyranny of Experts develop your argument further?
Tyranny of Experts really goes beyond the whole question of whether aid works, which, as we were just talking about, aid is really too small to make that much of a difference. So even if it did work, it wouldn't make that much of a difference. So now the big question is, if aid does not achieve development, then what does? And the answer suggested by this book, but much resisted by the development establishment, is that it's fundamentally the rights and freedoms of poor people.
Well, the title of your previous book came from Rudyard Kipling's famous and racist poem. Where does Tyranny of Experts come from? Is that a reference to something from the Old Testament?
It's a reference
to the path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the inequities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men?
It's just really a reference to the arrogance of experts that I've observed in my career and that I was once myself.
So is that the dominant approach to trying to reduce poverty, relying on experts?
Well, I think that the dominant approach is one that is that puts experts at the center, because the dominant approach thinks of poverty as a long set of technical problems. You know, malaria is about trying to kill mosquitoes, so you do something like spraying a chemical called pyrethrum on the inside walls of houses.
Is that bad?
That kills mosquitoes. So that's a technical solution that seems to be so tangible and so appealing that that would solve the problem. What we're leaving out is, if the technical solution is that easy, why didn't the government in power set up a health service that did that already? It's the myth is that the problem is caused by a shortage of technical knowledge. It's not a shortage of experts. But actually, this fact about how to fight malaria by spraying pyrethrum on walls, that was first put forward in a British colonial report in 1938. It's been over 70 years that we've known how to do this. So why wasn't it done already? And the answer this book suggests is fundamentally it's because of authoritarian governments and the experts who work with them who, you know, are not really motivated to solve the problems of the poor. They just want to stay in power. They don't care about the well-being of the poor.
Haven't they distributed mosquito nets?
Yeah, there's been a lot of efforts to, you know, again, the focus is always on these tangible solutions, which sounds very appealing and straightforward. What we're really not asking are two questions, why did the solution not happen already? And is the solution going to stick? Is it really going to last once the aid agency or the foundation goes away? And the answer to both questions is that it's very pessimistic when you have an autocrat in power and when the aid agencies and foundations like the Gates Foundation are even praising those autocrats for being part of the solution when really they're part of the problem.
You're particularly critical of technocrats. Are the technocrats offering advice on development? Are the ones who are doing that primarily research economists?
No, we're not. The problem is not really academic economists. It's more economists and other social scientists who go into the policy world and think tanks or working directly for aid agencies or foundations like Gates or Rockefeller and become sort of public intellectuals and sort of preach their message of this long list of technical solutions that will solve the problem.
So is there a divide between what economists think need to be done and what agencies and donors think?
I think academic economics has long recognized kind of the centrality of the rights and freedoms associated with institutions like democracy and markets, that's the central way in which development actually happens. But the operations of the agencies, aid agencies and the foundations, they don't operate that way. They, in fact, are praising these dictators that are in power. The Gates Foundation, to give you an example, Mr. Gates, upon the death of the longtime dictator of Ethiopia, Meles Zenawi, in 2012, he praised him as someone who'd made a lot of progress in development in Ethiopia. He described their wonderful working relationship, him and Meles. But at the same time, Meles is a guy who was caught red-handed manipulating famine relief from donors to go only to his own supporters. And even when that Human Rights Watch made that allegation public, nothing was done about it. The aid agencies at first promised to investigate, they never did. Nobody criticizes. There's a sort of silence about the misbehavior of oppressive autocrats and the violation of the rights of the poor that really bothers me in the development field.
Well, why would the Gates Foundation praise somebody who didn't do what they claim is their goal?
Well, I think, you know, fundamentally, Gates and others have this sort of technocratic view of how development happens, and they have this very naive view that the autocrats they're working with are benevolent and are also have the same goals of development.
So they see themselves as being pragmatic in this regard?
Yeah, and, you know, perhaps they think they need to say nice things about the government and the country where they're working to be able to work. That's an excuse they often give. But that should not shut up the rest of us. You know, the rest of us are allowed to criticize the autocrats that we think are the primary obstacle to development. They're not the solution to development.
And you say the technocratic approach ignores the fact that the unchecked power of the state against poor people without rights is the real problem.
Yeah, yeah. Let me give you another example from a different country. The World Bank did a forestry project in Uganda in which, at first this sounds like a good technical solution. Maybe the agricultural experts decide forestry is better than food crops for this piece of land, and that will raise poor people's incomes. This happened in a district called Mubende in Uganda. But the way it was actually, the way things actually went down was that men with guns showed up at the houses of the villagers in Mubende. They burned their homes down. They torched their crops. They kept them at gunpoint from rescuing their own burning homes. There was an 8-year-old child who died in this fire.
And what was the reason?
The reason was the farmers were being dispossessed of their land. They were marched away at gunpoint and told the land was no longer theirs. And the land was given to a private company under World Bank, IFC, International Finance Corporation auspices to develop the land as a forestry project. So that's where you go wrong when you disrespect the rights of the poor. You could actually be doing harm instead of good with this so-called apolitical, evidence-based, technocratic solution.
We saw something similar happening in Kenya where an activist went against the government in an attempt to plant trees and to initiate other programs that would actually help the environment. Eventually, she wound up winning the Nobel Prize, but she faced an awful lot of government opposition. I think she was even thrown in jail.
Yeah, yeah. This is a sad reality throughout a lot of the authoritarian countries that receive aid. And, you know, we should think of people exercising their rights as really being a big part of the solution. You know, they know, they have the local knowledge to know what will work for them. They choose freely what works for them and their communities, and they are the ones who do find the solutions.
Well, you mentioned the Gates Foundation, and we could probably cite a number of others. But what about the national donors like the United States or Britain or the Scandinavian countries? Did they also abet the denial of rights of the poor?
Very much, yeah. I mean, let's not pick only on Gates. I mean, for example, praising Melis Inoue.
Although he probably has more money than some countries.
Yes. Praising Melis Inoue, the dictator of Ethiopia, was done by USAID, by the British Department for International Development, by Dr. Jim Kim and his predecessors as presidents of the World Bank. Everyone seems to be enamored of the idea of sort of benevolent autocrats, which is just the opposite of the truth.
But doesn't the West fund its aid projects with the notion that recipients will follow the model of Western democracy and American-style capitalism? That's the total opposite to what you're talking about.
Yeah, they pay lip service to that ideal, and they even have some fairly lame, minus, very small efforts to promote democracy using really awful euphemisms like civil society building and empowerment of the poor and so on. But the way they operate in practice is they're sort of openly giving direct financing to autocrats, praising those autocrats as getting the credit for development successes on infant mortality or GDP growth. And so, it's the walk that they're walking. It's not the talk that they're talking that bothers me.
Well, what would the alternative be, to just simply deny funds to countries where there is a lot of poverty?
Yes. if you're financing an autocrat like Melis or like Museveni, who is the dictator in Uganda under which this rights abuse happened, you're actually doing harm to poor people. You're not helping poor people. So there's a straightforward case for just cutting off that aid. Now, I don't want to say that this is an easy problem, but aid is not the only player in this world. You know, we're having a big worldwide debate on democracy and development, in which we see the front lines in places like Ukraine and Russia. And, you know, what's sadly happened in aid is that aid has been on the autocrat side because they say, well, you know, we can only operate if we kind of side with the autocrats. But they're kind of the loudest voices in the room on development. So they're distorting the whole worldwide debate on democracy and development because the loudest voices in the room choose to censor themselves to praise the autocrats and to not talk about violations of rights and the cause of democracy openly. in specific instances like these countries, as opposed to the any sort of vague generalities that they may make. They're all, in any specific case of autocratic oppression, they're always explicitly praising the autocrat.
My guest is William Easterly, professor of economics at New York University, director of NYU's award-winning Development Research Institute. His latest book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor, published by Basic Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with William Easterly. His latest book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor, published by Basic Books. And you talked about part of the problem is our support of autocrats. But let's look at some countries that have been rather successful in helping their poor. China, Singapore, both autocratic regimes. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on that in the book because that really can those two countries in particular contribute to this myth of the benevolent autocrat. So there's a couple things to say. First of all, there are an equally large number of actually much larger number of autocrats that have mediocre or actually disastrous growth performances. So when you sort of pick out the most successful autocrats of all, that's not a general case for autocracy. That's just showing that there's a very, very variable set of outcomes under autocracy. And I think China is probably the most relevant and interesting case. And here what we have to remember is that the reason we're celebrating China is because of its rapid economic growth rate. So that's really the change in economic development. Well, you achieve a rapid change in economic development by having a disastrous initial position and then changing things for the better. And that's really what's happened in China. You know, China was a disastrous initial position. Been decades of the Chinese Empire, warlords, famine, Japanese invasion, Mao, civil war, Mao's Cultural Revolution, and Great Leap Forward, and famine, and all of this horrific oppression of Chinese, and compared to that...
So you say there's nowhere to go but up.
There's nowhere to go but up, and there's actually been a positive change in the kind of things this book is putting at the center, the rights and freedoms of poor people. Poor people have been able to switch from collective farms to growing their own food on family plots, which actually resulted a lot from just a spontaneous bottom-up movement. And, you know, entrepreneurs are able to start their own companies. And that's this change in economic freedom especially is explaining a lot of the success of China. So it's actually a case for freedom rather than for autocracy.
But on the other hand, we have countries that aren't autocracies, like Brazil and India, where nothing seems to work. We keep on seeing predictions of major positive changes. And now the recent election in India indicates that, if anything, the people of India are hoping that a little more autocracy will help.
Yeah, well, India is a good case to remind us that democracy is about much more than majority vote elections. India actually has had a lot of oppression of the poor's rights by corrupt police forces that are in league with sort of upper caste elites. And that's, the violation of the rights of the poor and of minorities is itself a violation of democracy. Democracy is not only majority voting, but a protection of the rights of individuals against what the state can do to them. And that's what India has always failed to achieve under its... It does have majority voting, but it's failed to achieve the protections of the rights of the poor.
And Brazil, which people keep on predicting will become a superpower sometime in the future, but can't even get its World Cup act together.
You know, Brazil certainly has a long way to go. I think, like the rest of Latin America, it's in a very long transition towards initial position of great poverty and also a brutal autocracy for many years in Brazil.
Well, how much of this is just a legacy of colonialism? At least that's the excuse that's often given.
I think that's a valid excuse. I think we do have to take history very seriously, and certainly the history of colonialism, which is itself an authoritarian system and also one that was very technocratic. And so I referred earlier to that 1938 British colonial report in Africa that was, you know, very much the same idea of the benevolent autocrat, except the colonial authorities thought they were the benevolent autocrat. And that's the system that lasted for centuries in Latin America and Africa and Asia, and that is to blame for a lot of the poverty.
You criticize what you identify as top-down methods of addressing poverty. Is a top-down approach distinct from a technocratic one?
No, they're really the same. The top-down mentality is that the economists and the engineers at the top already know the answers and can just kind of announce the answers, and these answers will somehow be implemented. And the bottom-up approach realizes, the answers don't implement, technical answers don't implement themselves. They have to be implemented by people who have the incentives to implement them. And those incentives only appear under a system of widespread rights, both economic and political rights. Economic rights give problem solvers the right to keep the rewards to their own problem solving. And in the political sphere, political rights give people the ability to make politicians into problem solvers, because we protest vociferously if they fail to solve our problems or if they create new ones. Like, for example, here in our own New York City area, we saw Chris Christie suffer grievous political harm from just creating a traffic jam on a bridge.
You know, if he did it, he denies.
Well, whatever. That's our democracy in action. That's our ability to kind of force politicians to be benevolent to us and punish them bitterly when they're not is what makes government work.
But I'm thinking about another kind of top-down. When the French wanted to adopt the metric system, they just legislated it. And meanwhile, in this country, we're still stuck in an outdated system of weights and measures. And maybe it would require somebody just simply saying, we, as has happened elsewhere, Canada and in England, the English gave us this outdated system, we're just going to switch over.
Well, you know, there are things that can be done at the center and that have been done at the center that can be in our good.
We have this whole business with the incandescent light bulb and people complaining we're being told we have to use a more efficient light bulb and forcing us not to use the inefficient incandescent light bulb.
Well, yeah, there's lots of things like that where there is some solution at the center that could improve things. Like, say, one of the great successes in U.S. government history is the interstate highway system, which could only be done at sort of the central level. But the key thing we have to keep in mind is that you need people with rights to kind of serve as a sort of self-correcting feedback mechanism that keeps the government doing good things and keeps them from doing disastrous things. You know, everyone loves the interstate highway system, and that was positive feedback that allowed it to be implemented and expanded. And, you know, if instead there's a traffic jam on a bridge, we protest that and we keep that kind of bad stuff from happening. That's the self-correcting system that you need for government to really operate well.
Do you think that technocratic or top-down aid policies necessarily fail to respect the rights of the people who are being aided?
You know, I don't think it's intentional. I don't think technocrats, aid experts, aid officials are intentionally bad. They're not holding up signs saying we want to violate rights of poor people. I think they're just so focused on the technical solutions that they have this myth that they can be apolitical. And again, they're failing to ask the question, if the technical answers are so easy, you know, why didn't they happen already? And it's because of a bad political system in which the government is not motivated to do good things for the poor, that there are not solutions already. And that's what the focus should be on.
The Muhammad Yunus and his Grameen Bank won a Nobel Peace Prize for developing microcredit programs. Do you think that that microfinance is a more promising approach?
Microfinance is one of a large number of development fixes that have come along at various times that have been celebrated as sort of panaceas that will fix things. And in that regard, they've been, you know, microcredit, as well as others we could talk about, have been disappointments. They don't deliver this kind of original promise that it would make everyone into a businessman, able to sustain themselves getting microcredits. Now, they do have sort of more modest benefits, and I think that's what, you know, social entrepreneurs and innovators like Muhammad Yunus, who I really want to celebrate, have actually done a lot of good by creating something that turned out to be different from what he expected. It actually is most useful for the poor as just a a way to smooth over their incomes, to get over bad times, and to use the surplus in good times to save for bad times.
You describe a debate that never happened between Friedrich Hayek and Gunnar Myrdal. How did they represent the current disagreement over how to aid the poor?
Well, Myrdal was very much the technocratic development economist, and he really was one of those who created the whole field of technocratic development, which sort of seceded from the rest of economics. And Hayek, although he's, mistakenly, I think, seen as kind of an extremist today, was actually much closer to the economics mainstream. It sees, it's sort of a spontaneous system of problem solvers that solve most of our problems, not technocrats from on high.
Perhaps one of the problems with Hayek is something like this. There's a set of interviews with him from 1983 in which he says he has, quote, no racial prejudices in general, but there were certain types, and conspicuous among them the Near Eastern populations, which I still dislike because they are fundamentally dishonest.
Oh, dear. I didn't know that quote.
So but I'm not that's hard. It's hard to look at a man like that who says something like that as an ideal person to deal with the problems of the poor.
Yeah. Well, I'm not here to defend Hayek. The ideas that he presented and the ideas that I agree with do not depend on whether Hayek was a good person or not, or whether he said some really bad things or not. Ideas have to be judged on their own merits.
Well, many people right now are talking about inequality as the biggest problem. Do you agree?
Well, I think it is
the 99% versus the 1%.
Yeah, certainly. It is. It is very much concerning and tragic when there are so many poor people left behind at the bottom, or when the incomes of the middle are stagnating. These are real tragic problems. I think we have to keep inequality in perspective as being not the only thing going on. I mean, the long-run trend of what's going on has been this massive increase in incomes, average incomes of all classes, that's happened over a very long period of time in which there was democracy in, for example, the U.S., and there was economic rights for the poor in the U.S., and those were used to really raise tremendously the standard of living and to actually apply a lot of those technical solutions and make them work for us, for the majority of the population. That's the long-run big success story that we have to set against the inequality, which is so regrettably high today.
Here in the United States, some, like the legal scholar Cass Sunstein, advocate using what we've learned from behavioral economists to nudge people to make better choices, what he calls paternalistic libertarianism. Would such policies count as technocratic or top-down?
Well, this paternalism is pretty mild in what Cass Sunstein is saying. It's much worse in poor countries where we really think poor people are fundamentally irrational and people are extremely paternalistic in a really insultingly condescending way. I think what you have to consider is, first of all, the burden of proof is really on you to prove that people are not acting in their own interests and that you as the expert can do better than they can to solve someone else's problem. And second, you have to wonder how good is the government at actually solving these alleged problems of irrationality, because the government is itself staffed by irrational people. So you have irrational policymakers trying to solve the problems of irrational behavior, of allegedly irrational behavior of the citizens.
Now, what we've saw at the fall of the Soviet Union, the shock therapies imposed by experts from the West, they seem to have been a total disaster. Is this part of the problem, that technocrats and top-down policies are almost predicted to make?
Yes, very much. And that example is good because it shows us that some technocrats will offer their shock therapy and their sort of coercive, imposed external solutions that they're so arrogant about. They will do so in the name of freedom and the political and economic freedom in the former Soviet economies. But that's not freedom when you impose your own view as an expert on another society.
William Easterly, his latest book is called The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. It is published by Basic Books, and Professor Easterly is a professor of economics in New York University, director of NYU's award-winning Development Research Institute. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.